How do you like your coffee? Freshly roasted? You can just smell it, can't you? Well, how would you like it brought to you? If you're passionate about your coffee, then a Passion for the Bean is for you. At a Passion for the Bean, they custom roast coffee beans from around the world when you place your order, so your coffee is guaranteed to be fresh, rich, full-bodied, and full of flavor. That's not the taste that you get from coffee beans that have been sitting on a supermarket or coffeehouse shelf for weeks. Now, to have the ultimate coffee experience delivered to your home or office, call a Passion for the Bean at 480-703-2326. That's 480-703-BEAN. A Passion for the Bean has joined forces with the American Stroke Association in the fight to end stroke. Now, you can help by purchasing an ASA signature blend, and 30% of the proceeds will go directly to the ASA. Help us put an end to stroke. The life you save may be your own. And call a Passion for the Bean today, 480-703-2326.
From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we're here on this show every week dealing with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So, today's topic, I'm actually not going to tell you what today's title of the show is until after I read the following. One of the many hats that I wear, in addition to being a licensed psychotherapist, is that I am also an ordained minister in the Universal Life Church. So for probably about 15 years now, I've been officiating weddings. For the most part, it's always been for people I know, friends or friends of friends. So on June 15th, 1996, this is the convocation in a ceremony that I officiated. And it goes, "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here to what? These words traditionally go on to tell everyone why we are here. But look at this couple. Some would say that this is not a traditional wedding couple and that this is not your traditional wedding. In some ways, those people would be correct, but not for the reasons they might give. Many traditional marriages include two people who stand before their witnesses fearful, questioning, and shaking at their knees, wondering if this will last, if they are really in love. Are they really loved? Are they doing the right thing? Maybe some of you have had that kind of wedding. Traditional couples see this moment as a beginning of a relationship or a new form of their relationship. Traditional relationships are thought of today as time-limited and disposable in the minds of many who take this step of public commitment. This couple who stand before all of us today probably would not even be considered traditional within some gay and lesbian circles. Some in this community think of same-sex weddings, commitment ceremonies, holy unions, or whatever you want to call this, as a political statement and an act of self-empowerment. Often this comes from a place of anger and a statement to society that we will be seen as the same as everyone else, or maybe they need to prove to society that their difference is most important. Tradition is important. Jim and Dan are probably two of the most traditional people I have ever met. This is probably the most traditional wedding ceremony I've ever had the privilege of attending. The tradition here is that these are two people who love one another and have no doubts about that. Jim and Dan are a couple who have devoted the last 5 years of their lives to being sure of the commitment they make before us today. They are sure because they made their commitment years ago and have done everything in their power to work together, play together, live together, and feel together. They have loved together and sometimes fought together, but they are here today in the presence of all of you who mean so much to them to declare that they are together. Love is the tradition we honor here today. The ceremony is not a beginning of a new phase in Dan and Jim's lives. It is not an excuse to have a party, but a reason to celebrate. They have demonstrated through their love and devotion to their love for themselves and for one another that this relationship is to be celebrated. The convocation went on, and this was a ceremony held in the backyard in the presence of about 40 of their closest friends and relatives, including both sets of parents and step-parents. And one thing I remember after the ceremony is one of the men's stepfathers coming up to me with tears strolling down his face, saying he never understood the reason and purpose for a gay or lesbian wedding until he heard the words spoken at this wedding and understood what this meant to Jim and Dan. And he was totally moved. He said it was the most moving and important wedding ceremony he had ever attended. The topic of today's show, if you haven't guessed so far, is marriage equality for GLBT relationships. As we all know, this is a topic that has been in and out of the media for years. And with the elections coming up right now, it's being used again as another political tool. There are some of you listening that maybe already are tempted to turn off the show. There are some of you listening that may be angry enough to call in. There may be some of you listening that are so glad to hear this on the airwaves during drive time that you'll call in with words of support. So I remind you that this is a live call-in show. And if you're driving around or listening anywhere else or even out of the Phoenix area on your computer via the Internet, the number to call is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. So with all that being said, I want to introduce my guest tonight. Her name is Amy Cobetta. She's the Director of Public Affairs for the Arizona Human Rights Fund and Foundation. She has the professional experience, which is primarily in political organizing, media, and political messaging. And prior to AHRF, she worked in the Public Affairs Department as Planned Parenthood of Central and Northern Arizona for 5 years and was the Director of Communications for the National Office of Parents, Friends, Families and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. Amy, I really want to thank you for taking time on your Friday night to join us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm pleased to be on the show.
Well, I was really glad that we found you this week because, as I told you, I had another guest planned and they got sick, and God bless you for jumping in yesterday and saying you'll be here. So,
well, you know, marriage, gay marriage and marriage equality are huge issues in this country and in this state right now, so I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk about it.
Okay, why do you think it is such a hot issue? Why do you think this is so strong, whether you're liberal or conservative, progressive, religious, non-religious? What's going on in this country today around this, and why?
Well, I think there's a number of factors that are going on, and one is the need to divert the attention of American voters away from the mishaps caused by the Bush administration and use gay marriage as a ploy to, you know, kind of keep the eyes away from what's going wrong here in this country and overseas. So I think that that's one factor that's going on. And the other is that, we as the LGBT community started talking about marriage equality, you know, back in the 90s. And I remember when I first heard that people were promoting marriage equality, I thought, oh, no, you know, that's never going to happen in my lifetime. Why are you talking about this? There's so many other issues that we could be dealing with. And it really rocketed as an issue that resonated in the community, whether pro or against the issue of marriage. So there was kind of an excitement within our community about this that was building, and then it triggered an excitement on the other side of the political aisle, so to speak. And so I think that, you know, it's caused a cultural impact. And so it's something that resonates with people. Marriage is a very personal issue, and it resonates with a lot of people. So I think we're seeing all of these things happening.
Well, I agree with that totally. And yet, even, and it would astound me, even if the Republicans and the Bush administration was having an amazing administration and wonderful things were happening in all of our minds and opinions, this would still be a very hot issue, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't think that they would have made it such a particular issue in this congressional session. But yes, it still would be an issue. It's been an issue in states around the country as they've been voting on constitutional amendments. And it's definitely an issue that's playing here in Arizona as well, since the kind of the extremist agenda has decided to take play here in Arizona with this so-called Protect Marriage Arizona Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we definitely would have seen this anyway.
Okay, so what is happening in Arizona? What is the particular, is it called the Protect Marriage Amendment?
They're calling it the Protect Marriage Arizona Amendment, which I actually think is a ridiculous name, because banning domestic partnerships or gay marriage does absolutely nothing to protect heterosexual marriage, and it does absolutely nothing to harm heterosexual marriage. So so it's really just an absurd title, but that is what they're calling it, yes.
Well, there's a book that came out, I think, about a year ago called Why Marriage Matters by Evan Wolfson.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to read something here. It's actually from page 8 and 9 in the first chapter. And I quote him saying, after careful consideration, this has to do with the U.S. Supreme Court, after careful consideration, the justices outlined four important attributes of marriage. First, they said, marriage represents an opportunity to make a public statement of commitment and love to another person, and an opportunity to receive public support for that commitment. Second, the justices said, marriage has for many people an important spiritual or religious dimension. Third, marriage offers the prospect of physical consummation, of which, of course, most of us call something else. The fourth, the justices said, marriage in the United States is the unique and indispensable gateway, the precondition for a vast array of protections, responsibilities, and benefits, public and private, tangible and intangible, legal and economic, that have real importance for real people. The Supreme Court, of course, understood, as we discussed above, that marriage has other purposes and aspects in the religious sphere, in business, and in people's personal lives. The justices knew, for example, that for many people, marriage is also important as a structure in which they can have and raise children. But when examined with the U.S. Constitution in mind, these four attributes or interests identified by the court are the ones that have the legal weight. After weighing these attributes, the justices ruled in a unanimous decision that marriage is such an important choice that it may not be arbitrarily denied by the government. Accordingly, they ordered that the government stop refusing marriage licenses to the group of Americans who had brought the case. That group of Americans were prisoners.
Oh, how interesting. I haven't read any book yet.
It's an incredible book, because not only does it talk about what's going on right now, it really talks a lot about the history of marriage, and it blows apart a lot of the historical things that, you know, a lot of the people on the right have been saying since the beginning of time, this is the way marriage is, and there's total proof historically and in many other ways that the way we see marriage today in this country historically is not the way marriage has always been.
Oh, absolutely.
But the Supreme Court, the year that happened in the Supreme Court was 1987.
Well, I think that what the Supreme Court, all of those items that they stated are items that gay and straight people automatically relate to marriage mm-hmm. for themselves and for others. You know, it's interesting when you meet somebody new and you say to them, oh, are you married, you know, just in a social setting or whatever, And when somebody says, no, I'm not married, but, you know, my girlfriend and I live together, right? If you're talking mm-hmm. to a guy that you meet at a party, he says, oh, no, my girlfriend and I live together. There is an entirely different social and emotional context that you get from, oh, no, we just live together, as opposed to, oh, yes, my girlfriend and I got married last year. Mm-hmm. And so when people ask me if I'm married, my partner and I actually had a wedding ceremony last year that both of our families participated in. And when people ask me, you know, are you married, you know, it's kind of dangerous territory to start to tread on because you're never really sure how somebody's going to respond. And I say, yes, actually, you know, my partner and I were married last year. And because I want people to understand that our relationship carries that same significance and that same cultural and emotional connection that heterosexual married couples, their relationship also carries. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not together by accident. We're not together just because. We're together because we intentionally and publicly made a declaration of love and commitment to each other. And mm-hmm. I think it's sad that our courts recognize that, but that an extreme portion of our population here in America does not understand. We're not trying to, we being the LGBT community, we're not trying to create, you know, a new world of marriage. We're trying to take ownership of some of the meanings and rights that marriage gives couples and their families.
And responsibilities.
Oh, absolutely, and responsibilities.
Yeah, because I think that's important, that what gays and lesbians are understanding and willing to do is not just acknowledge that there are rights we get because of this, but there also are responsibilities that come with the legal commitment.
Yes, absolutely, especially if you're talking about kids.
Mm-hmm.
Know that and there are many, many, many gay and lesbian couples now that are raising kids, and you know the second parent, you know, for lack of a better term, is adopting those same responsibilities that any other parent would adopt, and responsibilities for the health and welfare of their kids as well as for their partners, and you know, and it's, you're right, it is about rights and responsibilities. And when I talk about this marriage amendment here in Arizona, you know, we talk about that people share rights and responsibilities for each other, mm-hmm. and that needs to be recognized. But
right.
I did just want to comment really briefly about this amendment here in Arizona. It does two horrible things, and one is to just outright ban gay marriage in the Arizona Constitution, which is just a shame to put discrimination enshrined in our Constitution. But it also would deny any government entity if you extrapolate that out, any business that is receiving monies from a government entity from offering domestic partner benefits to its straight or gay employees.
Hmm.
And so you're talking about firemen and policemen not being able to take care of their families. You're talking about kids that are going to be going without health care. And so this is really an extreme amendment. They're not talking about gay marriage. They're talking about redefining relationships. And that's really scary that this really out of the mainstream interpretation of relationships is being forced through this political realm.
How much support does this have in the legislature in Arizona?
Well, the legislature is a very conservative legislature here in Arizona, and we are grateful to have our Governor Janet Napolitano, who keeps them in check on social as well as fiscal issues. But the legislature isn't directly related to this particular amendment. This amendment is going to end up on the ballot if they receive enough signatures from voters. And what they're saying is they're having a problem getting those signatures.
That's a nice indication.
Well, I actually am a little suspicious of that. I think it's hype. I know that they have enough money and power to get those signatures that they need by the deadline. And I think that it is playing very well in the LGBT community to make us more complacent and you know, take us off our guard, which is we need to be better prepared than we are now, and we can't kind of fall into their rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I know we wanted to talk about marriage, but I just wanted to let that know for your listeners that, you know, this goes beyond marriage, and this is just a really awful amendment. So thank you for my little political commercial there.
No, I mean what you're talking about is totally on topic, you know, and I think it is important because I think a lot of the people who are talking about marriage or save marriage and all this other stuff are really using it as an umbrella to deal with a lot of other discriminatory policies.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
What you're talking about is exactly that.
Well, and what we're hearing, the extremists, I don't want to paint all of our conservative extremists as Republicans, because we've got some good Republicans, but we've got some bad Democrats. So when I say extremists, I really do mean kind of those cultural extreme rights that we have here in this state and in this country. And, you know, and they're talking about moving relationships back to that 1940s, 1950s model, where you never have sex before marriage, where you're married and you're married for life, that you only marry for procreation and you have as many kids as God gives you, and that, you know, living together or having kids outside of a marriage or being divorced is shameful and sinful. And so they're starting with gay marriage, but at the risk of sounding like an alarmist, I think that it's a much broader agenda that they're really fighting for. And that's why they add things like banning domestic partner benefits. So they don't want single people living together. They want you to get married and have kids. That's not the choice that everybody wants to make, but it's the choice that they're trying to make us choose.
Well, that means that someone like my dad and my stepmom, who are married, wouldn't have been allowed to get married because procreation was not a part of their lives by the time they got married. They already had adult kids.
It's interesting. I'm not going to name the person who did this, but we receive candidate questionnaires back. One of the things that our organization does is we query candidates on where do you stand on LGBT issues concerning safety, adoption, marriage, harassment, public accommodation acceptance, things like that. And so anyway, so we get this questionnaire back from a candidate, and what this particular candidate wrote regarding the marriage questions was, yes, gay couples can get married, but only if they adopt orphans. And
what?
So, I had never heard that particular argument before, but it just is it's a funny example of how people have so ingrained in their mind the issue of having kids and being married. So according to this particular candidate, gays could get married, but then we would all have to start to adopt children. And we had a good chuckle over that one.
That's like if we all have to adopt children, that's like those poor kids that are going to end up having to be adopted by people who shouldn't be parents, whether they're gay or heterosexual. There are plenty of people out there who, just because they have a license to get married, and in that sense, according to the more conservative people, that only gives them the right to have kids. But we all know that not everybody should be having kids.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Being married, whether you're gay or straight, should not be an obligation to have children if you choose not to have children. And and that's always been something that I've strongly believed, especially during working at my time at Planned Parenthood, is, you know, a lot of young couples saying, you know what, I just don't want kids, or I only want one kid. And, you know, people need to be able to make those choices without this kind of conservative agenda telling them what they should do.
Yeah. Well, historically, going back even thousands of years, the mandate about getting married and having kids was really for the survival of the family and the survival of the culture and the survival of the tribe, because the more kids they had, knowing that a lot of them were going to die out, the more chance they had of surviving and moving into another generation.
Yes.
And
when you
and
had
for
six,
a lot,
you would have
yeah,
six
go ahead.
Kids because you would know that only two of them would end up making it to adulthood. And I mean, that sounds horrid to us now, you know, kind of hedging your bets as you're having kids, but, you know, that was the reality back then. But now we have much lower infant mortality rates, you know, cleaner, you know, cleaner living environments. We have antibiotics, you know, that mm-hmm. need to have a lot of kids to make sure that you continue that family line. That need just isn't there anymore.
And there were economic reasons for having a lot of kids way back, which, and in some cultures even today, because the more kids you had, the more the farm was able to be worked, mm-hmm. the more hands you had, the more kids or more people that were out there as they reached a certain age, bringing money in to support the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I want to remind my listeners, if you want to call in, if you have some questions, if you have some comments, pro or con, about whatever we're talking about here today, the number is 480-949-1310. That's 949-1310. So with dealing with this, we've talked about children. We've talked about procreation. We have talked about the conflict that's going on all levels of society, and I know that in a lot of ways this has even torn families apart. You know, being a therapist and being 56 mm-hmm. years old, I've been, you know, so to speak, as a lot of us say, in the trenches throughout the last 25 years of this AIDS epidemic, and the marriage issue came into play very often back then in relationship to the rights of inheritance and health care decisions and things like that. And too often the horror stories, I've known a number of guys when their spouses died, when their partners died, that there was no marriage certificate. And even if something was written into a will, the family of the deceased partner, who hasn't spoken with that son for maybe a decade, had the legal rights to come in and take everything that was owned there, and sometimes even the house or mm-hmm. the apartment that they were living in.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
so that the surviving partner had no legal rights for something that he may have contributed to for 10 to 15, 20 years.
And that actually just happened recently, probably about 2 months ago, to a lesbian couple here in the Metro Phoenix area. And partner died, and they had decided ahead of time to divide their assets, you know, and so the partners, the soon-to-be deceased partner, she was planning her will, said, you know, my family will get half, and you will take the other half, and that's how they decided it. And the family came in and said, no, we want it all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and leaving that living partner, not only, you know, in grief over the loss of her loved one, but now
exactly.
having to face this awful, awful legal and, quite frankly, political challenge
mm-hmm.
to protect what is still hers. You know, we get very nervous about that, even though you have all those legal documents. You know, death does weird things to families, and
definitely.
I'm sure your experience as a therapist has shown that. And, you know, the most healthy family all of a sudden becomes a little crazy when you're trying to make those really difficult decisions. And I think it's exacerbated if you have a gay couple and, you know, kind of those seeds of homophobia in the family. And
right.
It's very difficult.
Well, even the issue of death being hard to deal with, one of the reasons this happens very often is because the partners, even if they know one partner is sick and dying, they still have a difficult time talking about it and dealing with these issues and putting all the legal ducks in order
yeah.
so that it all happens too fast and everybody's kept their head in the sands and nothing's happened.
Well, and the other aspect to that, though, is if you've ever seen all of those legal documents, they're
right.
incredibly overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
I know a friend of mine has been trying to get my partner and I to sign all of the lines, you know, and make sure that every paper is in order. And, you know, and my partner and I just are overwhelmed by all of the decisions that you need to make. And you're making them today, and what if it's different tomorrow? But, you know, heterosexual couples don't have to worry about that. They don't have to wade through all of those papers and those legal technicalities And so I think it's just so much easier. Because I know my family says, oh, well, you know, you don't need to be married. You can just get those papers drawn up. Well, mm-hmm. you know what? It's not that easy. It's $1,000+, and it's a lot of time, and it's a lot of effort. It's you don't just, like, go in and, you know, just sign a paper. It's much more intense than that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
definitely.
So I think there's the legal aspect. And then there's also just the... you know, in terms of marriage causing confusion and some trauma in families, is I have three sisters. I have an older sister and two younger sisters, and one of my sisters is a devout Catholic. And when my partner and I were married last year, you know, she sent me a letter saying, I can't come because what you're doing is a sin. And, you know, and I thought about that for a very, very, very long time. And, you know, my personal decision, because whenever families deal with this type of conflict, it's always a personal decision. But my personal decision was to say, okay, where can I find common ground with my sister, even though she and I disagree on some absolute fundamentals? But how do we move forward from this? You know, and how can we find a relationship beyond what I perceive as her bigotry and what she perceives as her deep-seated faith?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of work.
How'd you get there?
Or
where did you end up?
Actually, you know, I just got back from a weekend in Wisconsin. My oldest sister just had a little baby, and so all of the sisters met in Wisconsin along with my mom and had a delightful weekend together. My very Catholic sister, she and I talk a lot about her kids and home decorating and the weather, because we find that those are the easiest topics to discuss.
Uh-huh.
But she also made a silent commitment to our friendship and our sisterhood. And where we have our differences, we don't dwell on them. And I think that's taken me many years as a political activist to recognize that sometimes you lose forward. Sometimes you don't say, okay, that's it. You know, what you're doing is awful, and I'm never going to talk to you again, because nobody ever wins there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just have to say, you know what, we're never going to agree on this, but our relationship as sisters is more important. And that was tough, and that was very, very tough. But I think in the end it is worth it, and I hope that any of your listeners out there who are struggling with those family issues and those dynamics will go through that hard work to get to that, because it's a much better place to be in than to be angry and resentful all the time.
Right.
And so
now, I know that you work for people like Parents and Families and Friends of Lesbians and Gays.
Yes.
Was this an issue you found you had to deal with much amongst the people coming to those meetings or involved with that? I mean, were you hearing a lot from the parents and friends that were struggling with this with their gay or lesbian loved ones?
Yeah, what I found a lot in my years there was a lot of parents would come, and one parent was okay and with their child being LGBT, and the other parent not so okay. And so many times it was, you know, for example, the dad was okay, but the mom wasn't. And so the dad is coming to these meetings saying, you know what, I'm trying to get there with my kid, and I'm doing all that I can, and I need some information because I'm still confused. And, oh, at the same time, I'm trying to, you know, create this new relationship with my child. My marriage is now falling apart over this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very difficult time because the parents who are accepting want to keep the whole family together and, you know, kind of feel like that obligation to, okay, I have to take care of my gay kid, but at the same time, I have to make sure that I'm keeping the rest of my family together. And it was a very difficult struggle for them. And I think that the comfort and the advice of people who had lived through that made it a lot easier for them. And it's amazing how many PFLAG parents, you know, you see 10 years later and they say, you know what, I hated it in the beginning. I can't believe my kid was gay. I wanted to kick him out of the house. And now, you know, the joke was always that the PFLAG parents are gayer than their kids. You know, they're always, they got the ribbons and the triangles and the I love my gay son t-shirts and, you know, and then the sons are like, oh my God, Ma, put it away, you know, because they're so enthusiastic about it. Now, my parents never got to that point, but they got pretty close. So, you know, there's hope for everybody.
Well, let's hope so. I believe that, too. So, again, there are people out there listening. If you want to call in, if you have something to say about our topic tonight, which is on marriage equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgenders people. And my guest is Amy Cobetta, who's the Director of Public Affairs for the Arizona Human Rights Fund and Foundation. And you're listening to Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM 1310 in Phoenix, and that means that the phone number is 949-1310. So feel free to call in if you have a comment, question, or whatever it is you're feeling or thinking about today's topic. So, Amy, I want to read another passage from Evan Wolfson's book, Why Marriage Matters, and it's about two paragraphs here, and it's on page 167, 168. Marriage, as we have seen, has always been a battleground for larger questions of inclusion, equality, the separation of church and state, and the proper boundary between individual choice and government interference. African Americans were denied the right to marry altogether as a way of denying their full humanity. In some states, Asian Americans and members of minority faiths face marriage discrimination. In the infamous Nuremberg laws aimed at shoving the Jews outside the status of citizen and ultimately person, restricting the freedom to marry had a central place. And before the obstacles to divorce were removed in the 1940s and 50s, before married and unmarried couples could decide for themselves whether to use contraception, before legal race discrimination in marriage ended in only 1967, and before laws making wives legally inferior to their husbands were taken off the books in the 1970s and 1980s, the opponents of change were making the same predictions they're making today. The institution of marriage and civilization itself will be destroyed if the discrimination ends. Each and every time opponents of equality said the proposed change was against the definition of marriage and against God's will. In his book, a 1996 book, One More River to Cross, Black and Gay in America, Keith Boykin, founder of the National Black Justice Coalition, devoted an entire chapter to the common language of racism and homophobia, noting that arguments once used to justify segregation and racial oppression now figure in the right wing's anti-gay campaign. I think I'm encouraging you to really get this book and read it, aren't I?
Well, I know Evan, and I know how bright he is, and so it's I'll have to put it on my book list tonight.
Mm-hmm. Actually, about a year ago, I had Mark Leno, the state assemblyman from California, who actually was instrumental in pushing the marriage rights bill through the California state legislature, and Schwarzenegger had actually spoken in favor of the bill and then ended up vetoing it when it finally got to his desk. And Mark was the one that actually, when I heard him speak, quoted from this book a lot, which is why I went out and got it. And Mark, I really give him credit because he really did some amazing things here in California and still is.
So
what are your thoughts about all this historical stuff and discrimination amongst other groups and how it's being used today?
Well, I think that sometimes the analogies are appropriate. I have found that as a middle-class white woman, it's very weird for me to be comparing my right for marriage equality to the oppression that African Americans faced, you know, years ago and actually still face in so many aspects of our society. So I'm hesitant to compare those oppressions. But I can draw on my own feminist background and look at the way, you know, women were treated for so many years in the concept of marriage. And, Eastman when they said that, you know, even women getting the right to vote would end marriage and, you know, cause women
would end
to go
civilization
crazy.
As we exactly. know it, yes.
And I can draw on those comparisons and mm-hmm. be able to say, you know, it's social change is hard, and when we see the frenzy that we see now, I think it is because the other side is realizing that they're losing the cultural war,
mm-hmm.
that when we are polling younger Americans, what they're saying is, yeah, gay marriage is fine. We don't really care. We've got
right.
lots of gay friends. And I mm-hmm. think that we're seeing that conservative movement start to panic and say, oh, no, we're losing our base now. The world is growing up to be a much more accepting place. If we don't do this now, you know, we'll never do it. And so as I, at least maybe this is what I tell myself so that way I can get up every morning and not feel so distraught some days, but I think that the battles that we're fighting now are kind of a sign of that last-minute frenzy that they're feeling, because they're feeling like that power that they had over the cultural agenda is starting to slip. And I would bet that, you know, you saw the same type of thing happening as opinions were shifting toward marriage for other oppressed groups here in this country. So mm-hmm. that is my hope. And if I have to keep fooling myself about that, then I will continue to do so. But that is my hope, because it keeps me going every day.
I don't think you're fooling yourself. I mean, I came out of the closet when I was in college, which was like right after Stonewall, like 1970, 71. And back then we figured, you know, okay, this is great. We can at least march now and things like that. But we're never going to see a lot of the rights that we really want and everything else. But that today, you know, over 30 years later, we are seeing. And, you know, as you just said, the generation behind us is a lot more amenable and a lot more supportive and have a lot less issues, even in spite of a lot of the conservative stuff they're hearing and may have even been raised in,
yeah.
that there's that thought in my mind that says, well, in another generation, this is going to be a moot point. But what I'm beginning to get is it's not going to take another generation.
Well, it might take another generation or two, if we don't continue to, if we don't continue the struggle, and if we mm-hmm. sit back and say, "Oh, you know what? All of this," and I've had conversations with people who think this. They say, "You know, there's really no point in fighting so hard now because it's all just going to go away in a generation or two, and we don't have to worry about it." And I think, but in that short time, while we're sitting around and waiting for the shift to change, the laws can change today, and then it's mm-hmm. going to take even longer to get those laws off the books and reversed, and it's mm-hmm. it's legal battles, and it's just it's a lot of money and energy spent in the future if we could just stop them now. So I'm always very concerned about making sure that that extreme agenda doesn't get codified into law, mm-hmm. and if we can just keep them back and keep promoting equality, not only in marriage, but also in jobs, also in housing, also health insurance benefits, all of that, then we will be able to be in a better place once those, you know, once that cultural shift happens, maybe over the next two generations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Let's talk about Massachusetts for a while, because everybody thought that once, you know, they were allowed to have legal marriage there, that, you know, civilization was going to totally fall apart there.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that you hear very little coming out of Massachusetts anymore, except for, you know, Romney occasionally, you know, blowing off some steam, trying to position himself. But it seems to me that if and I think it is going to be, I think, another 3 years they could put it on the ballot for the voters to vote it up or down at that point. It seems to me at this point that they've seen that it really hasn't made much of a difference in their own communities.
Even the
What do you know about what's going on in Massachusetts?
Well, there was a legislator, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but there was a Republican legislator, and Massachusetts Republicans are much different than Arizona Republicans. And and so this particular legislator was the one that really led the ban, that really was opposed to allowing gay couples to be married. And then, you know, years later, when he was approached to be a part of this challenge to gay marriage in Massachusetts, he said, look, you know what, it's all been fine, and I've changed my mind on this, and
wow,
the sky has not fallen, and it's just not my priority anymore. And I think that that is a perfect example of how somebody who was so opposed eventually comes around and sees that that it has benefits to society as opposed to dismantling society.
Let's talk about the benefits. What are the benefits of allowing GLBT people to marry legally? I mean, we're not talking about forcing religious entities to officiate these weddings. We're talking about civil marriage.
Exactly.
Licenses.
And religion should always have the right to decide what is right for them. You know, we are not in the business of trying to change somebody's faith, but it is a civil aspect. And so, but what they're, you know, what a lot of the studies have shown is that even among, you know, heterosexual and gay couples, is that marriage has health benefits. People tend to be happier and healthier when they're married. Some of my friends who live in Massachusetts who have kids, you know, have said that it's really changed the dynamic of their family. It's made it easier then when one of the moms takes the kids to the doctor, takes the kid to school, takes the kid to soccer practice. There's none of that, who are you, why are you here, you know, aren't you the mother, who is the other mother, that kind of, all of those questions that so many couples face. And so their lives and their kids' lives are easier.
Well, take it to a broader point. Not just how will it benefit GLBT people and their kids, how will it benefit society as a whole?
Well, I think that it will do a lot to move people to a greater sense of understanding and acceptance and peace with the people that are around them. And kind of as I was talking earlier about, you know, me kind of overcoming this discomfort with my younger sister, you know, your life is just better when you're not so filled with anger. And I think
yes,
that as people start to see that that their homophobia is has no basis, and they can move on with their lives in a happier, healthier way, and we can start to see each other as a larger community, we can start to value each other's relationships on an equal basis. I think that that moves the society into a much less stressful and much more productive place.
Right, and I think that's a big part of it. I mean, speaking as a therapist, if, you know, knowing that GLBT clients and myself and friends, that if we're dealing with less stress and we're more at peace with who we are, we're contributing more, we live happier lives, we stay healthier longer, we're less of a drain on the healthcare system, less of a drain on the mental health system, we're less of a drain on the welfare system, on drug abuse issues, and which depletes then productivity on the workplace. There is a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond the GLBT people, you know, those of us that are GLBT, it then has, I believe, a ripple effect on those that are around us.
Yeah.
Because if there is more peace and stability in more components of a community, it has that much more peaceful effect on the community at large.
Yes.
And more productivity being contributed.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. It takes a lot of time and energy to hate.
Yes.
And as you move to a better place where you're not so filled with fear or confusion or anger against somebody because of their sexual orientation or even their race or their gender or their ability, I think that, you know, that person who is no longer filled with that anger and that discrimination and that bigotry, I mean, they're just happier people as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it definitely has an effect.
I agree totally, and I think it's an important factor that really needs to be brought out, and I think even some of the campaigns by those of us that are supporting this, it would be a great thing to do a spot with that politician in Massachusetts, you know, showing him saying one thing at the beginning and then 3 years later saying the opposite, I think would be a very powerful public relations spot to use.
Yeah, I agree. Unfortunately, voters in Arizona are very concerned about voters in Arizona. And when you mention what happens on either of the coasts, whether it be California or the Northeast, they say, oh, those are those crazy liberals. We're not like that.
Those New Englanders. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, Republicans in Massachusetts are much different than Republicans in Arizona. But I think Arizona is seeing its own shift in attitudes as more people are moving into Arizona. You know, the demographics are changing, the ideas are changing, the culture is changing. You know, we have a huge Latino population in Arizona, but we're also getting more African Americans and more Asians. More Native Americans are coming off the reservation, and so we're starting to see a greater diversity in our everyday lives here in Arizona. And I think that over the next few years, you know, we'll see some shifts, hopefully, in attitudes.
Mm-hmm. And you're getting a lot of us Californians out there, too, and a lot of the retiring New Englanders that are changing the demographic,
yes,
too.
Exactly. Although those Californians, they're driving up our housing rates. But other than that, we love people from California moving here.
So we're
always hopeful for change. We're always fighting for change. I think in the end, you know, as I was working at Planned Parenthood, I said this and I say it now, that 10 years from now, I want to look back and say I was part of a change. And the work that I did every day changed my life and the life of the people around me and the people that I care about. And, you know, I don't want to assume that I'm some type of pioneer or Gloria Steinem, but I really believe strongly in the work that so many LGBT activists are doing you know, creating those kinds of changes. And that right. You made a comment earlier about gay marriage not necessarily being political, but I think it is political in the smaller sense of political, or maybe the more universal sense, I guess. You know, when I stood up there with my partner and said, I do, and when a lot of people that I know get up there and say, I do, it is a moment that is of love and commitment and dedication. But it's also a moment where you say, you know what, I'm going to make a statement about my relationship in this world that does not accept who I am. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a real political sense to that.
Right.
And many people
I agree with you totally, because what I was saying in that conversation was that some people do this for political reasons, some people do it for other reasons, but Jim and Dan were doing it for purely relationship intimacy issues, the commitment they had in terms of who they were to each other. It wasn't a political statement to them, but I do agree on a certain level. I think it's a political statement for everyone that does something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we only have a few minutes left. I want you to talk about AHRF for a minute and how people can reach you or support the cause here.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So we have about 60 seconds to talk about that before I do my closing.
Well, the Arizona Human Rights Fund and Foundation is Arizona's statewide gay rights lobbying, advocacy, and education organization. And we work on a local level to educate folks, community at large, as well as decision makers and elected officials. We lobby at the Arizona legislature, and we also support LGBT candidates and LGBT-friendly candidates. So if folks out there want to make a difference in Arizona politics, the Arizona Human Rights Fund and Foundation is the way to go. You can learn more about us by visiting our website, and that's www.ahrf.org, arizonahumanrightsfund.org. And all of the information, ways to get connected, right there on the website.
Okay, and I also want to remind people, if you didn't get any of that, it's easy to remember Tell the Truth Faster. If you go to the website for this show, tellthetruthfaster.com, This particular show will be up in the archives within the week, so that this show and every other show I've done for the last 4 years is there for any purpose you need to use it. If you want to hear it again, if you have a friend or family member that you think needs to hear what was discussed on the show, it'll be up in the archives in MP3 format, and you can just download it and listen to it anytime you want. But it also has a link on the page for this week's show to get to ahrf.org, so you can always just remember tellthetruthfaster.com and go to the website, and you can also email Amy Cobetta from the website ahrf.org. Am I right about that?
That's right.
Okay. So before we close, first of all, Amy, I really want to thank you for being here. I think this is a very important show and topic, and it's close to my heart, and I know it is to yours and many others.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed my hour with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And before we close, I want to wish my mother a happy birthday today. She's 83. And yesterday, her domestic partner, Tony, turned 90. And I want to honor them for living the life that they choose to live and for being the people that they are and for loving me for who I am and what I am just as fully as any parent could. So happy birthday to both of you. And I want to thank all of you for listening. This is Stuart Altshuler with Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix, Arizona. Be back next week. We'll be talking about 25 years of the HIV epidemic. So listen next week again. Have a great weekend, everyone.